show is called Maria. Welcome to Maria. For honesty and to the point news. Opinion straightforward, you can't lose. Get ready, subscribe, let's go. Welcome to Maria. Get to know Maria. Popular opinion or not, you know you're gonna hear a lot. From guests with credentials that say, I won't let America go astray. The show is called Maria. Get to know Maria. Listen to her truth and views. You're bound to love Maria.
Okay, today is yet another episode in Food for Thought with myself and my great co-host, Will Tuttle, the author of The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony. Maybe we should call him Where's Waldo, because he's always on the road. How are you, Will?
Hi. Great, Maria. It's good to be connecting with you again.
Well, I'll tell you, these shows are really making an impact on my listeners, you know, and I do one with Ronnie Cummins of Organic Consumers once a month, too.
Huh?
And we're changing the way my listeners shop and eat.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's probably for the best for everyone, for the earth and for future generations and for the children.
Right. Especially for the children. You know, Newsweek, I just got their latest issue, Love Mother Earth. I guess they want to cash in on Earth Day. But I'm sure there won't be any articles in it on the best thing we can do for the earth is to stop animal farming and eating animals.
Exactly. It's the one thing, the most obvious thing anyway, that is sort of enthusiastically ignored by everyone from Al Gore to the Sierra Club to the environmental groups. It's really the most powerful way that we can bless our world ecologically and environmentally is to eat lower on the food chain. The best thing is to eat a totally plant-based diet, because as soon as we start eating animal foods, we start massive pollution of the air and the water, and besides all the suffering, and it takes
right.
a lot of plants to. But these and these animals are not very efficient at converting plant foods. Most of the energy from the plant foods is basically just wasted in the metabolism of these animals over the months and years that they're alive.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right, and right now, I mean, on the planet, you have over 100 countries rioting over food because there's not enough food to go around.
Oh, see, that's the thing. You know, we're wasting food. We're growing more than enough food to feed everybody on this planet right now. I mean, a lot of experts say we're growing enough food right now to feed probably 10 billion people, but we have close to a billion that are chronically hungry or malnourished, not getting enough to eat, and then we got another roughly almost a billion that are chronically obese and overweight from eating all the animal foods that have so much fat and cholesterol in them. And no one seems to, in the richer, the richer people, of course, are the ones that are getting fat. And no one really wants to address that. The richer cultures, actually, it's very interesting because a lot of the more obese people in our culture are people who are lower income, because the way the subsidies work, it actually gives a lot more money to people to industries to make high fat foods that are actually end up being cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So people actually in the lower incomes in this country actually tend to eat higher fat foods because you can get more for your money, basically.
Right.
If it's cheap meat and.
Well, now that you know the price of food is skyrocketing, there was an article in the paper.
Right.
That's it. People are eating better. They're buying more vegetables. They're buying more fruit, and they're passing up a lot of the processed stuff just because they're stretching the dollar. And shock of all shocks, parents are actually starting to cook again.
That's good news. That's good news. That's great. Well, you know, I think it's interesting. Like you said, I'm on the road full time. We've been for the last few months in Florida, and we just headed up the last couple of days up into Georgia. Now we're up in Athens and Gainesville, Georgia. Actually, today we're in Gainesville. And this area is, the local people say this is the home of the chicken industry. There's everywhere you look, there are chicken factory farms just all over the place. And I actually gave a lecture on the World Peace Diet here and recently, and it was interesting to see the audience were pretty much, you know, more than half the people were obese, And they were, but the thing was interesting was that they were very open and receptive to the message, like you're saying. I think people are realizing, I think this is one of the most important things to actually realize, and this is a point that I emphasize over and over again, is that none of us have chosen freely to eat a diet based on animal foods.
Right.
We're all forced into it by our upbringing, by our culture as children.
Mm-hmm.
When we realize that it really wasn't our choice, then we can perhaps be less defensive about it and see that we're forced into it by every institution in our culture, you know, by our parents who were forced into it by their parents, or it kind of goes back that way, but also by the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the media, the government, the religious institutions. Every institution in our culture is organized around the fundamental core of our culture, which is basically just seeing animals, seeing, you know, beings as things to be used.
Right.
And that's what I argue in the World Peace Diet, is the core of our culture. So if we really want to be able to be free and to have the foundation for peace and sustainability, we have to look at the living core of our culture, which gets reinforced every day through our meals, and it's ritually injected into us, this mentality of dominating other living beings, caring about their welfare, of just using them, seeing them as commodities, the mentality of exploitation and of oppression and of disconnectedness from their welfare, and we're all forced into it. And and the thing is, it's just a small step.
I remember exactly when that started happening in my own family.
Right.
You know, when Mom all of a sudden decided, now we're eating meat. And, you know, I wasn't an infant. I mean, I was probably about 10 or 11 years old.
Wow, that's unusual.
And questioned, you know, why are we eating this crap? You know, I'm happy eating pasta with this, pasta with that. But in those days, that was, you know, you heard that famous expression, your father worked hard all week so you could have meat tonight. Who cared? Who wanted it? I want to say, tell him to take a day off.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, that's unusual because most, I think, in our culture today, at least, and actually for me, too, growing up, it was like, you know, and if you go to the baby food section of any grocery store and just look at the little jars there, you'll see veal and roast beef and turkey and chicken and cheese, macaroni and all this stuff that little kids get right from the start.
Right, and they always spit it out, and then you shovel it back in, and they spit it out, and you shovel it back in. Maybe the parents should take the hint that the kid's spitting it out. It's not a good sign.
All right.
But, you know, you did indeed grow up, you know, in a farm-like community. And I grew up from, you know, the second generation of Italian immigrants living, you know, in a tenement in Brooklyn. So, you know, peasant food was what we ate. You know, of course, now if you go out to dinner and you want to just have spaghetti with olive oil and garlic, they're going to charge you $20 a plate. But, I mean, we ate that because it was what we could afford.
Right, exactly. And that's how it typically always was, really. It was only the very wealthy elite that could actually afford to eat meat regularly. But with the subsidies and the ability, actually, with the invention, really, after World War One of nitrogen, being able to, you know, get cheap nitrogen, which allowed growing a lot of grain, and then the feeding this grain to animals, it just made an explosion of meat. And it was all subsidized, and I think that's really behind the whole explosion of the pharmaceutical industry, because you have now so many very sick people, both mentally and physically very sick from eating all this misery and toxic.
Right. I mean, I got a report off Planet Ark today that said two more people died of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in Europe.
Mad cow.
Right. So, of course, they're connecting it, you know, to, you know, the renderings and the bone and the other disgust that they feed to cows.
Right. Right.
And, you know that expression, you are what you eat. And I was thinking about you this week in the lingerie section, nothing personal, Will, but I was in the lingerie section of a clothing store. And you came to mind because I remember our last discussion where we talked about treating women like we treat cattle, and women exaggerating their body features the same way we inject cattle to be bigger and better and whatever. And I can tell you, I don't think I've ever seen so many D's, double D's, triple D's size bras in my life.
Wow.
And I thought of your book immediately, and I was like, wow, I guess this is like the new size for women, you know?
Yeah.
And thought about our conversations about that.
Right. Yeah, I think it really is very ironic. And in a sense, it's kind of humorous. You know, this whole thing that with dairy production that we we basically have this mentality where women are, unfortunately, and it starts pretty young, really, are reduced in our culture to being just merely physical entities, you know, that are here for the pleasure of men. You know, that's very demeaning to both men and women to just see them as meat, like we do to animals that we're going to eat. We see them as meat, and this whole mentality gets in really deep. And the dairy products, I think, really with all of the estrogen and hormones and fat and cholesterol that are in cheese, I think it's one of the forces that, you know, that make women's breasts just bigger and bigger, which becomes the really, you know, somehow this kind of perverse idea that that's desirable somehow, more desirable than something else. And so the more they eat the flesh of these animals and the dairy products that go with it, the more the breasts grow, and that somehow becomes some kind of favorable.
Right, and then you look at our children who already look like, you know, they're 25 when they're 11 from all the hormones in the food they're eating. And it's really sad.
Right. Well, that's something that most people, I think, still aren't aware of, that there's a tremendous hormone load in dairy products, and it's concentrated, actually, in cheese. Because a lot of people will say, well, we don't drink much milk. But, you know, you got to remember there's 20 to 30, depending on the type of cheese, if it's hard cheese, up to 40 or even 50 pounds of milk in 1 pound of cheese. So you're getting a huge amount of dairy and fat and cholesterol and hormones in these in cheese and in yogurt and all these foods. And even in boys, it tends to make breastiness. But I think in girls, it's...
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's why we have a need now for the man bra in our society.
Well,
taking a line from Jerry Seinfeld.
In Puerto Rico, I guess, after World War II, they started using more of the hormones on the cattle and the dairy cows than they usually do in this country. Here we tend to get the cows to give more milk through feeding them a lot of cholesterol and meat. We feed dairy cows a lot of fish and chicken and rendering plant slaughterhouse waste and stuff to make them give more milk. But we also give them hormones.
Well, we also give them chicken shit, literally.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't going to say that, but yeah,
well,
we give them that too.
Well, I can say it. I'm not as neat as you are.
But in Puerto Rico, there was a case where they were giving them, they didn't have that much of the other stuff to give them, so they were just giving them a lot more hormones.
Mm-hmm.
And the boys and men in general all developed breasts from all the estrogen load that was left over in the milk products that they were all eating. And this is something I think that's happening anyway in this country because we have so much hormone use today in the milk. And it's something that was recognized very obviously in Japan right after World War II again, and I mean in the last 30 years, where in the space of just one generation, the average age of a girl's first menstruation just dropped dramatically from around 17 or 18 to around 12 years. And just in that one generation when they started eating a lot of dairy products.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads to so many disasters, teenage pregnancies and all the stress that goes into all that and abortions. Mm-hmm. And,
right.
This whole driving force behind these battles of between around abortion and all these things. So much of it really just comes from dairy products forcing little girls to be able to be, sexual, to be able to be pregnant at an age when they, it's really not.
Right. We're raising an entire generation of little Lolitas. And it's hard. It's hard being a girl and being developed early because you really, your mind still feels like a kid, but your body doesn't look like it. So it puts you into a mental quandary, too.
It does. And these foods are forced on kids in the schools, which is another thing that I think, by the parents too, but also by the schools. I have a friend who was an art teacher in a school outside Chicago who just tried to basically raise awareness in the school about what this was doing to the children, and they just fired him as fast as you can believe. They just fired him. They said,
oh, yeah, they didn't want to lose all that free meat and contracts of the garbage meat that they put through the school system.
Right, exactly.
At least some schools have taken out the soda machines and the other crap that's in there. But they're still shoveling down those burgers and the worst cheap garbage chopped meat they could possibly serve. And that's what I wanted to talk about today. I think that, it's really important, especially since it's Earth Day coming up. And, to me, the best thing you could do for the Earth is go meatless. Looking at our children, I think it's important to talk about our children. They're saying that this is the first generation that won't outlive their parents in American history.
Right.
Because of, you know, they're fat, they've got grown-up diseases, you know, they're feeding their mind and their body and their soul on nothing but garbage, you know, 24 hours a day. I think that's pretty sad.
Yeah, well, it is. It's very beneficial, again, for the wealthy elite. It makes a huge profit on sick people. But for us, for all the people and who are living here, it is an ongoing disaster for these children and really, I think, for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
For the future generations.
Right. Now, I know you got a note from a child in Palo Alto this week asking you about animal abuse. How did that kid come to find you? Did you speak at her school or anything like that?
Right. Well, you know, being in Georgia, it's tough, but the friend I was referring to, who's a school teacher who is working in this more and more, is in touch with them and some other people, just giving her information. And I think one of the things that he's finding, and I think more, I think perhaps we will find, is children themselves starting to stand up, you know, starting to say, don't feed us this crap anymore. You know, children themselves get it going online, you know, and, you know, I recommend to kids just go online and just Google factory farm and Google vegan and just find out for yourself.
Mm.
And start to take, you know, responsibility for your own health, because your parents won't do it, and the schools won't do it, and the ministers won't do it, and the government won't do it, and the corporations and the media won't do it. Then, you know, do it yourself. That's the only, you got to do it yourself, because our culture, you know, there's not many people who are actually advocating compassion for children in the sense of not abusing them. And I remember I wrote an article called the title of the article was The Most Pervasive Form of Child Abuse. And in the article I said that I believe that the most pervasive form of child abuse is forcing them to eat the flesh and secretions of brutalized animals from the time they're very young, because it's terrible on their minds, it's terrible on their bodies, it creates a basic sense of disconnectedness from nature. We don't want to think about where our food comes from. We're taught not to think about it. We're taught to disconnect from the cruelty of these animals,
mm-hmm.
to eat foods that are carcinogenic. You know, they found now when they do tests on children, even at the age of only 3 or 4 years old, they already have, you know, significant plaque in their arteries,
mm-hmm.
precursor to heart disease and atherosclerosis. And
yeah, they say by the time a kid's in high school, they've got it all.
So early, right?
I know. It's really criminal. And you know what? I did a news show, I don't know, maybe a week or two ago. I believe it was Scotland, where they're actually pulling fat kids away from their parents.
Really?
And they give the parents 3 months to get those kids into ballet, football, et cetera, and have them lose a certain amount of weight, or the state is actually taking their children away for abuse.
Yeah.
You know, of course, you know, I wish they would have had pictures, because I wanted to see if the parents were also little weeble people. But, you know, I didn't see any pictures. I mean, I'm not saying that that's right, but obviously some countries are indeed classifying having, you know, little fluffer nutters for your kids as child abuse.
Right. Yeah, I think in this country it probably wouldn't happen, because McDonald's, I mean, these corporations that feed high-fat, toxic foods are so powerful that, you know, it's just great for the pharmaceutical industry. It's great for all the corporations that are basically running the government. So.
Right, and it's pretty sad. You know, when I was younger, it was very rare that you saw a person that was overweight. And that person, I could tell you, was tortured, okay?
Yeah.
And now, I mean, if you go out anywhere, you go to a mall, you go, you know, take a walk around a lake or whatever it is you do, I'm willing to say on a low scale, at least 50% of the people are toddling around very overweight. Not, you know, 10 or 20 pounds. We're talking they're little round weebles. They can't breathe. You know, I can just see the stress on their body, the stress in their breathing. And a lot of them are very young. So it's almost like a reverse now. You know, and on this planet, we have people that are two extremes. You're either very fat and sickly, or you're starving to death and very skinny and sickly. And I think it's criminal. You still with me, Will? Did I lose you?
Yeah. Yes. And I think the whole key to this, to understanding this, is to simply, like what we're doing right now, is to just talk about these things, to raise awareness. And it's going to have to come from a grassroots level. It's not going to come through our mass media because it's too controlled by the corporations that are getting rich on the misery that we're inflicting on children, who then grow up and inflict it on their children. You know, they're not going to know any different. So it has to come through people questioning what we're doing to ourselves. And I think the beauty of this kind of conversation that we're having is that it hopefully helps people realize that veganism, which is simply just having compassion for animals, is not a radical, extreme idea. It's really our natural way of being. What we would naturally yearn for is kindness for animals and health for ourselves, health for our environment. It's really our true nature. And we've all been raised in a culture that is dominated by a certain mentality that serves just a few people, and that we have to begin to question that. And we've all been, in a sense, made into victims of this mentality, and we have to kind of, in a sense, root it out of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So once we do that, we can begin to really live in a way that is healthy. And
right. Well, you know, looking at your book, The World Peace Diet, you have a couple of quotes that start off chapter 4.
Uh-huh.
One says, it's by John Wynne Tyson. It says, it is nothing less than a form of violence to attempt to win children over to the toxic poisons, the coarse flavor, and the unsympathetic texture of animal flesh.
Right.
Then you have one by Tolstoy. It says, this is dreadful, not only the suffering and death of the animals, but that man suppresses in himself unnecessarily the highest spiritual capacity, that of sympathy and pity towards living creatures like himself, and by violating his own feelings, becomes cruel.
Right, exactly.
And I, you know, that's one thing I told you, I think, the first time I read your book, is I really love the spiritual connection you make between what we eat and our spirituality. And I never saw anybody else do that.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's kind of a virgin territory. No one's really gone in there before. But I'm so glad that we can talk about this, because I think it's not just the physical disease that we inflict on ourselves by eating all this horrible, tortured animal flesh and all that stuff. But really, what it does to us spiritually and psychologically and emotionally and culturally, you know, mm-hmm. what it does to us, it just puts us in a state of not being able to make connections, of not feeling good about ourselves. You know, I just read today that child suicide over the last 30 years has gone up 400%.
This
kind of misery is increasing in children, and I think it's the root of it is this food. Children are eating misery. They're eating fear. They're eating terror. They're eating panic and anxiety, and they're not taught where it's coming from and what it really is. And so low self-esteem that children have, in the sense of living in a you know, just being reduced to an economic unit in a heartless economic system, you know, that
right, a consumer.
Animals. And I think we feel that way ourselves, and our children, I think, feel that. They feel like they're being raised in a system that forces them to just be reduced to some kind of a consumer that has to raise money to just consume, and we lose touch with our spiritual essence, which is to see the sacred and the beauty in all of life and to celebrate that and to just enjoy each other and to have compassion for all life. There's nothing more beautiful than that.
Absolutely.
Chill out in the children.
Right. And, you know, children have a natural love of animals. And when children are small, they don't make the connection. The parent tries to hoodwink that kid every which way they can into whatever that fried mess is on their plate. They'll never tell them that it's an actual animal.
You have no way to conceive it. I remember I was the oldest kid. And I had a brother 2 years younger than me, and then I have a little sister 2 years younger than him. And so I was given the responsibility to feed my little sister, you know. So I was maybe like 7 years old, and she was like 3 or something. And I remember, or 2, and I was maybe 6. And I remember, you know, trying to get her to eat liver, you know, and forcing it into her mouth. And
man,
how she always,
that's a hard one.
She nor I really had any idea what liver was. You know, we had no really way of conceiving what we were doing. To me, it was just a game, and to her, it was just horrible, you know.
Right.
But we don't know as little kids what we're doing, and we don't have even the ethical equipment to make those kinds of decisions and connections, but we would for sure, you know, our feelings are destroyed. And I've heard of a lot of stories. When I travel around this country and lecture, not only do I talk to people born and raised in the cities, but I talk a lot to people that are born and raised on farms.
Mm-hmm.
I hear so many stories from kids, from both boys and girls, especially boys, how they're forced to raise an animal, maybe a pig or a cow, and then how they're forced to kill that cow.
Right.
How, you know, they're so...
it's traumatizing.
And they're just broken by this. Their father says, you know, if you don't kill this cow, then you're not my son. You know,
right.
And
So after you name it, after you play with it, after you raise it, you get the pleasure of sitting down and seeing it on your dinner plate. And yet they don't understand that that's traumatizing to a kid.
Well, see, and that explains so much about why men in our culture in general are disconnected from their feelings. You know, a lot of men just don't even know what they're feeling at any given time because they've been taught, we've all been taught, I think men especially, just to not feel, because we wouldn't want to feel what we're eating, what it went through, to get it on our plate. We just learn to disconnect from our feelings. I think otherwise our natural tendency would be to probably, every time we bit into a burger, would be to either scream or start weeping, you know,
or heave.
What we're actually eating.
Heave ho. You say in your book, you know, and it is a seduction through advertisement without question. You know, I remember, you know, Bessie the cow, you know, promoting milk and all this crap when I was a kid. In your book, you say McDonald's spends
happy.
As much.
They're just kind of skipping to the slaughterhouse, dancing with glee.
Right.
They'd rather
just,
do than give our, their
right.
lives.
Just being...
And it's just the opposite. You know, I tell in the book how, when I was about 13 years old, I was part, you know, I went to the summer camp up in Vermont where it was affiliated with this organic dairy, and we slaughtered, I remember I slaughtered my own chicken for the first time. I cut her head off with an axe. And that was not that traumatizing for me because I was already so brainwashed after 13 years of being forced to eat chicken and turkey
mm-hmm.
and you know, other animals every day that I just thought that, you know, that's what you're supposed to do, and God didn't give them a soul, and you know, I would die within 24 hours of a protein deficiency if I didn't eat these animals. And,
right.
And then, but then I remember a few weeks later, we all... You know, about 30 kids, we stood around and we shot a cow, a dairy cow, in the head with a gun and killed her. I mean, we shot her and she dropped. She was still, her heart was still beating. You know, she was convulsing on the floor of the barn. And the guy who owned the dairy told us, you know, she's not giving enough milk, so we're going to use it for meat. You know, that's what you do. Here's the farm and we're going to use it for meat. And how he just cut her jugular vein. He cut her head right off with the knife immediately afterwards, and how... When, as soon as he did that, the blood, her heart was still beating, so the blood went through the air in these arcs, and I was shocked, you know, to see this, because I had never, you know, obviously had never witnessed a live animal being slaughtered, and I think it did something to me, you know, it was shocking, but at the same time, it was like, well, this is just an animal that's just here to be eaten, you know, that was the feeling I had, that was what she was here for, and you just use them, And he explained to us, which was very interesting, actually, to think about. He explained to us after he, you know, cut these veins and the heart actually pumped the blood out of her flesh. And he said, you have to do that because if you just killed her somehow and then cut her up later, the meat would be disgusting. It would be soaked with blood. No one would ever want to eat it. It would be terrible. And we humans don't like to eat bloody meat. You know, we like the meat to be, you know, drained of blood. So you have so that's why the animals all suffer so much. All of the animals, whether they're chickens, pigs, turkeys, cows, sheep, goats, even fish, they're all cut. Their arteries, the main arteries, are cut so that they can bleed out. And
but isn't a lot of the taste that's in meat from their urine?
Well, it is. Yeah, of course. That's what gives the meat its distinctive taste, actually, is the uric acid, which is in the cells of the animal's flesh, which is actually on its way to the kidneys to be converted into urine and urinated out. But that is what gives meat its distinctive flavor, which is really why, even though people, you know, try to make plant-based foods that taste, you know, as much as possible like meat, it's never quite exactly like meat because unless you put uric acid in, I guess.
Right, unless somebody's urinating on it like they do at the chicken farms, urinating on the chickens for fun. I don't mean to make this a disgusting conversation, but I'm just remembering yet another article I just read about some chicken farm where that's what they like to do to torture the chickens, urinate on them.
Urinating on, I know, it's true. It's vicious.
I mean, you know, what kind of sick people do stuff like this?
Well, it's people who are, you know, it's really we're all responsible. You know, if I go to a store and take out my wallet and pay for some flesh of some animal, some chicken or cow, you know, I don't do the actual killing with myself with a knife, but I think I really am responsible for the hardening of the hearts of other people that have to stand in these horrible places and do nothing all day but stab and brutalize animals, and that brings out the worst in anyone. You know,
of course.
Worst in people.
It's got to make you
twisted. Like Martin Luther King
twisted.
Said, violence anywhere hurts everyone everywhere. We're all connected. That's the basic spiritual truth, is we're all connected, and our welfare is all connected. So we can sit in our, you know, classy restaurant and order our filet mignon or order our, you know, duck and goose and chicken and all these things, and we don't see where it came from. We don't see the utter hells.
No, we don't make the connection.
Lived, and the utter hells that the people live in who do this kind of abuse to these animals and then go home to drug addiction, go home to enormous domestic violence, how they brutalize their spouses and their children, and the alcoholism and the suicides. These people just basically learn to disconnect from their feelings.
Right.
And lose the compassion that they naturally would have for other people. And there's a lot of evidence for that. There's a book, I quote her book quite a bit in my book, but Gail Eisenitz wrote a book called Slaughterhouse, which she has a lot of signed affidavits by slaughterhouse workers that really document the emotional toll that it takes, the kind of work that they're doing takes. They become vicious and brutal, and they do terrible things to these animals.
Right, and then they have to
they're so frustrated. You know, right. They're so frustrated, and they feel so horrible about themselves. And someone who feels good about themselves would never harm another. You know, it's people who really have been abused and are in abusive situations, and it was so interesting, too. One guy, in his affidavit, he said something that I thought was so interesting. He said, you know, he said, working down in that stick pit, he was sticking pigs, which means basically, you know, stabbing them. He said, you become as cruel as the company itself.
Hmm.
That was incredible. He said, you become as cruel as the company itself. Like the company... Because the company's always raising the speed of the line, so they have to work faster and faster. It doesn't care about the workers. It doesn't care about the animals. It doesn't care about anything but the bottom line. And he said, you become as cruel as the company itself.
Right.
These corporations,
then they have to...
I mean, the truth is they are heartless. I mean, corporations are, they're the whole existence of corporations is to limit liability, not be responsible for their actions.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that are hired by them have, you know, basically learn to be irresponsible, too.
Right. And meanwhile, it's not only killing us, the planet, the animals, but it's killing our children. Will, we're going to go to a short break. When we get back, I want to talk just for a minute to the work of Dr. Neil Bernard, who's been on the show many times, especially breaking the food seduction, and that it's not as hard as people think. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Food for Thought.
So many great books, so many great authors. Did you know the best book for personal advancement and spiritual growth is Maria's own Reinventing the Wheel, the Universal Wheel, Tool of Global Unity, available right here at www.maria.net. How does this woman stay so positive with all the madness she covers on the show? This book tells you her story and how to duplicate peace, happiness, and real spirituality into your own life. Simple Spirituality, simple tools for living in harmony with all life. And only available through the site maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. Order one today and start your true spiritual journey as a spiritual being, having a human experience. Buy a few for your friends. Change begins with you. Now, back to Maria.
Okay, I'm back with Will Tuttle. And we're talking on Food for Thought. I think that anybody that truly studies the spiritual message of the medicine wheel would really understand, or even if you are a Bible student, would really understand that we're here to coexist with the animals, certainly not for them to feed our souls in whatever way we feel we should. You know, I had that discussion recently, Will, with somebody where I said, you know, if you even wanted to go be a Bible stickler, you know, the reason the animals were created supposedly was because God saw that man was lonely.
Right.
He didn't say he saw man was hungry because he had already given them the perfect diet and said, out of all the fruits and trees, you know, is to,
yes,
you know, help yourself.
Right.
But it was because he was lonely. And then I think about a quote by Chief Seattle, who had said, without the animals, man would die of a lonely spirit.
Right.
And now we've become such shut-ins as a society where we're so lonely, we're so disconnected even from other humans, let alone from the animal kingdom, that I can see, you know, all the truth in that.
Yeah. Right. I think that's one of the main sicknesses of our civilization, so-called civilization, our culture, is our disconnectedness from the immense gift that animals can bring to us. You know, it's just being out, and, you know, Madeline and I live in an RV, so we just travel, and we, usually for a few days every week around the weekend, we're busy doing concerts and lectures and art exhibits in the city. But then during the week, we take 3 or 4 days and go out to a state park, and we swim in the rivers and we the woods, and we just get in touch with the birds and the fish and the animals. And I think, you know, I noticed that we're like the only ones out there. You know, there's usually no one else. No,
I know,
everybody
it's sad.
Is, for the most part, stuck in their cubicles and their cars and their jobs, and they don't.
And being the iPod people.
Contact with nature. You know, mm-hmm. it's so important, I think, to actually have a feeling for the squirrels and all the creatures and the animals, not just sort of like through watching them on videos. You know, like most people get their hit of nature through National Geographic, you know, things where they see, you know, some lion killing an elephant in Africa, and they think they just had a natural experience, you know. Mm. You can just get out there and smell and feel and develop an appreciation for the beauty of this incredible beauty of this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I put up on my blog yesterday a couple of pictures of my son feeding and petting the ducks at the lake here.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him, that's the highlight of his day, is going to see his friends.
Right.
You know, but there are few and far people in between that even notice them. You know, they'll notice the duck crap on the lawn, but they don't seem to notice the ducks.
Actual birds themselves are so beautiful, I know.
I know. Now, you know, I've had Dr. Neil Barnard on the show many times, especially when he came out with Breaking the Food Seduction. I said, okay, I got a chocolate addiction. He's saying I can break it in, you know, 6 weeks if I follow this eating plan. So, of course, I tested it before I had him back on the show, and it literally did take 3 weeks, not six.
Yeah.
And it was done. Now, he talks about, and you quote him a lot in your book, which is great, he talks about the fact that you can lose your taste for animal foods in the same amount of time.
Right. Well, the basic idea that he points out, and I think it's basically a physiological fact, is that the taste cells in our mouths, in the taste, we call the taste buds, turn over on average about every 3 weeks. So every 3 weeks, we have a whole new set of taste buds. So mm-hmm. the basic point is that if you can stick with something for 3 weeks and make a change in your diet, because that's what happens sometimes. People say, oh, I tried eating you know, a plant-based diet, but it just didn't taste the same, and I didn't taste as good as what I'm used to, or whatever. And even though you can make delicious vegan food, but anyway, the idea is that if you just stick with it for 3 weeks, then you'll have after 3 weeks you'll have all new taste buds, and that's all they know. And they to them it'll be delicious. You know, it'll be great. That's what they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there's been years of programming, it just only takes 3 weeks to actually have a whole new set of taste buds. And
right, and I can tell you, you know, in the beginning when I made the switch, I depended pretty heavily on the fake meat products, you know, the Boca Burgers, this, that, the other thing. And it helped. It really helped in the beginning. But then the longer you become vegetarian, the less you even want to eat that.
Right. True.
So, you know, if people realize there's a lot of ways you can do it gradually, nobody's saying, you know, change your whole life like tomorrow, although that would be nice. There are, you know, we'll call them crutches, or you can call them tools or aids. to help you bridge that gap. But I could tell you that I would sooner die than eat any kind of chicken, fish, beef, etc. I don't think I could ever go back to it. And I truly have zero craving for any of that. That went away, I would say, the first year.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, actually, I've been a vegan now for 28 years, and I'd have to say my spouse Madeline and I sometimes will buy some kind of Boca Burger or some kind of vegan thing like that, just because we like to try them and so we can recommend them to people. But for ourselves, there's just so many delicious foods you can make just from vegetables and grains and beans, legumes.
Right, and just so my listeners know, I just posted an entire vegan meal of recipes on the blog under recipes. So if you're not using the blog for what I post there in the news, get over to the recipe section because there's lots of easy, delicious stuff you could make. Because I know that's another thing we get so used to.
Right.
Setting our meals around, well, what are we having tonight? Roast beef. You know, we don't even mention what else we're eating. That people really don't know, well, what will we eat? You know, and it's not that hard to figure it out.
Right. People think that if you're a vegan, you're giving up something because the meal revolves around a piece of meat in the middle of the plate and a few side dishes. And so it's like, well, if you're a vegan, you know, you just kind of lose that. Where do you get your protein? You know, that's the question, you know. And so it's just basically a reorientation to realize that there's plenty of protein in plant foods.
I mean, absolutely. I told you that I had gone.
If you went through every single hospital in this country and looked at every single person in a hospital, you would never find one person that's in the hospital for a protein deficiency. You know, it just doesn't happen.
Right.
People are in the hospitals because they're getting too much protein, and that's very hard on the kidneys, the liver, the colon, the heart, the whole system.
Right.
More protein.
Right. People get you die from too much protein.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting. I think I told you that, you know, several months ago I had some blood work done. And he was amazed by how clean my blood is. Not only how clean, but how colorful and healthy. And he actually told me that my blood was healthier than any top athlete's blood he had tested. And he says, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a vegetarian.
Yeah.
And he said, well, what do you do for protein? I said, well, you're looking at my blood. You tell me. I said, it's a new invention. It's called dark leafy greens. And he laughed, and he said, just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I don't think that people realize if they, you know, maybe everybody should go for a blood test and take a look at your blood under a microscope, because that should be reason enough for anybody to want to go vegan.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And the sad truth is most doctors are utterly clueless about nutrition. I often say, you know, you'd be better off going to a car mechanic for nutrition advice than going to a doctor. Because the little bit they do know is usually wrong. So they really, it's better to find out on your own what actually makes good nutrition. And there's plenty. I mean, you know, foods like spinach are, you know, 50% of the calories in protein, spinach are protein. I mean, there's plenty of protein in plant foods. And you can create meals that are just unbelievably delicious. My again, Madeline and I, you know, every night when we have dinner and every day at lunch and you know, pretty much every meal, we just, as we give thanks for the food, we just think how funny it is that people who are eating animal-based foods think that, you know, somehow we have less variety. I mean, I have more variety in my diet than I ever had growing up, you know,
right.
Eating a basically meat-based
diet. Right, you're more creative.
Diet. Oh my gosh, it's much more creative, and it's much more bright and happy, and there's such
right.
a variety.
Well, you know, I have my son living with me now, and of course the dinner once again that I posted to the blog is what I made the other night. And he actually said to me that it was the most delicious dinner he's ever had. And I can tell you, I did that dinner in 15 minutes and probably cost less than $10 for the two of us to have that dinner.
Sure, right.
And, you know, then, you know, you're a little stuffed, but it's not the same as feeling stuffed after you eat meat that's going to stay in your, you know, your intestines for two or three days. And I said to him, well, if you feel full, then that discounts another myth that people believe if you're a vegetarian, you can't get full.
Oh, you can get really full, but you're right. It's a fullness that doesn't last too long.
Right, it's one that doesn't make you sick, and you're not like burping up. you're not like burping up meat for the rest of the night.
I know it exactly. Yeah.
But there are a lot of myths attached to it. You know, and unfortunately, the one myth that I wouldn't have minded would have been a little true is that, oh, you're going to get so skinny being a vegan. I haven't lost a pound in the years that I've been vegan. Or that, you know, you can't, you're not going to get your protein, or, you know, you can't get full, or the best question is, well, what are you going to eat? You know, there's nothing to eat. You must be eating the same thing all the time. And I kind of say that out loud every time I've got something sumptuous ready to be inhaled by myself, because I've got a healthy appetite. I'll say, wow, what are we going to eat? You know?
Right.
But I'm finding that, you know, more restaurants are catering to vegetarians.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
You know, there's some places you'll walk into, I swear they must have beef broth in their water. You know, they've got nothing on the menu. And instead of just leaving, I make a point of telling them, you know, why don't you at least squeeze a veggie burger onto your menu so that you don't lose the vegetarian customers that are coming in here.
Right.
But it's also it's an education program. So what do we do to help our kids? How do we help our kids?
The thing is, children in any culture are basically like sponges. You know, that's how we are. We land in a culture, whether it's, you know, here in Georgia or in Georgia, Soviet Union, or the Amazon, or whatever it is, and we're kind of hardwired, I think, to just look to our parents, to look to our culture for what's right. You know, how you live, what you eat, what you think, everything. We just soak it up. We're like sponges, but we're doing, I think, you know, our kids, you know, therefore they just take on the same behaviors, they take on the same belief systems, they take on the same foods just naturally. That the parents and the teachers and the uncles and aunts, you know, everybody is eating. So the biggest blessing we can give our children is to be an example of kindness, compassion, health, and spiritual awareness for them, and live lives, not just talk about it, but actually live a life that reflects the truth that we are interconnected with others and that shows compassion. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there may be cases, and it's happening more and more, where kids, even at young ages, are kind of taking their own life in their own hands and saying, no, I'm not going to eat the crap you're serving me anymore. I'm going to be a vegetarian, or I'm going to be a vegan. And that's, to me, a testament to the innate sanity of human beings at a deep level, that kids are able to even, you know, make these questions. But I think the best thing we can do is to have these conversations to debunk the absolutely pervasive and erroneous lies and stories about who we are as human beings, what we need to have, the basic idea that we're essentially predatory by nature, that we want to eat the flesh of animals, we want to attack and kill and jump on them and bite them, and, you know, these kinds of ideas. We're eating foods that are just not for us, and it's a very obsolete mentality. And I talk in the book about the three reasons that people eat animal foods, the main three reasons, you know, one of them being the fact that we just inherit it from our culture. We're forced into it by all the forces in our culture. I call it infant indoctrination. And we're all indoctrinated into it. And the interesting thing about indoctrinated beliefs is that it's very hard to question them, because they're not beliefs that we've arrived at freely on our own. You know, if I talk to someone who's eating chicken, say, or whatever, and I say, yeah, is that something that you just decide to do on your own? And they may... Probably they'll probably say no if they're honest, but if they say, well, yeah, I decided I wanted to eat chicken, you know, well, why do you want to eat it? Why do you think you should? Every reason that everyone has of why they're eating the foods they're eating are ideas that they never came up with on their own, but they were actually forced on them,
right?
Their culture. But since they didn't arrive at them on their own, it's very difficult to question them. So what people do is they just kind of either get aggressive and start getting angry and say, don't talk to me like this, or they just change the subject. You know, we see that all the time. Just change the subject. Let's not talk about this, you know, because it's very painful, I think, for us as essentially beings of consciousness and spiritual awareness to realize that we're unconscious and that we're basically living a lie. Mm-hmm. So that infant indoctrination, I think, is the most important thing to understand. And I call it in the book the importance of leaving home, which is just simply leaving home means questioning the underlying assumptions of our culture, and that's the way that we can actually contribute to the evolution of our culture, to creating a culture with more compassion and wisdom, where justice and peace are actually possible, where we're not slaves to this mentality of violence, which actually enslaves us.
Right.
And the other two reasons, one is social pressure,
Right. Oh,
children,
that's a big
all
one.
Of us are actually
right.
exposed to unremitting social pressure to eat the flesh and secretions of animals.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about you. I get tortured being a vegetarian.
Yeah. Right.
I might as well, if I told people I was a heroin junkie with AIDS, I'd be more accepted than saying, what do you got to eat besides, you know, chicken, fish, or meat? It's like, oh, no, one of those.
Right. And social pressure, you know, I think we humans are essentially pretty gregarious. You know, we just like to everybody to like us. We want to go along. We want everybody to think we're good. We're like them, you know. And so this is a powerful, powerful reason why people have a very difficult time stopping eating animal food. You know, one is the indoctrination, which is so deep. And the second one is the social pressure that's just everywhere. You go to the church barbecue and you want to fit in. You go to the office luncheon, you want to fit in. People want, you know, they go to the home for Thanksgiving and they want to fit in. This whole idea of, you know, fitting in makes it very, a lot of people, they just don't have the character or maybe just, it's just not, they're not quite, don't understand it yet enough, I guess, just to understand.
Well, that pressure is a lot on anybody.
But it's a lot, you know. And then the third reason is it tastes good, you know. It just tastes good. It just, we just like the taste, and that's another one I think you have to really look at. And I think when we look deeply into if we look deeply into all three of these reasons, we see that basically they're even though they're powerful, they're actually very weak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as we realize we're being indoctrinated, we can let it go. As soon as we realize that, you know, we're just being socially pressured into something we really don't believe in, we can pretty easily overcome that too. And the third one, taste, is a pretty powerful one for a lot of people, and it has deep roots because it goes back to psychological comfort foods that kids had when they were kids, you know, that people had when they were kids, or, you know, my daddy's barbecue, oh, it brings back all the good memories, or my mama's roast beef, and brings back all these great memories of coming home after school and she's in the kitchen maybe or whatever. So we have all these associations with food that are extremely psychologically powerful. So we have these tastes that we think we just really won't be happy unless we have those tastes. And yet when we realize what it actually is, it's basically just pleasure. It's just something I like for some reason. And is that actually grounds? Is that a valid reason for causing misery to others? I mean, because it's unquestionable that it causes misery to others. And if someone, you know, took their pet dog and cut the dog up and ate the dog, people would be outraged. And if they said, well, but it tasted so good, you know, I just like how it tastes. People, you can't.
Right, with the right barbecue sauce, I'm sure dog and cat would taste the same, too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so would, and human, I mean, flesh would taste the same, too. You know,
right,
but
might as well eat each other.
Repugnant because we care about other humans or we care about dogs. But the same thing is true of all animals. They all suffer equally and to be used as food. They're complex beings. So to use the justification of taste would be, we know at a deep level, it's absolutely wrong. You can't, you know, if I attack someone because I want to take away their umbrella or their watch or something that they have,
right,
I would face social consequences because our society recognizes that people's interests have to be protected. You can't just, you know, attack someone, steal something from them, hit them, kill them. But there's certain animals that we just don't protect their interests at all, and if I kill the animal or have someone else kill the animal, I not only don't have any consequences, negative consequences, I actually have all these positive consequences. You know, people say, well, that's a good idea to order that roast beef when we're in the restaurant or something like that. So I think, you know, it's just a matter of somehow extracting our mind out of the programming and realizing that our taste is just programmed also.
Of course, it all is. Let me recommend, I'm going to do a shameless promotion for your book again. Let me tell everybody out there, there's so much in this book that there's absolutely no way we can talk and tell you every word of this book, but you need to know every word of this book. And it's The World Peace Diet, Eating for Spiritual Health and Social Harmony by Will Tuttle. Get over to willtuttle.com or circleofcompassion.org. I want to just concentrate for a minute. You know, I have a lot of friends, Will, and they all call me and tell me what all their ailments are, okay? And I'm still at 58 years old on no medication and have no sickness.
Right.
And I listen to them, and they don't want to make the connection between what they eat. But you have on page 74 and 75 almost every one of these symptoms these people called me constantly complaining about, from macular degeneration to osteoporosis to their, you know, their eye capillaries clogged with debris to kidney disease, kidney stones, gallstones, direct result of eating animal foods, chronic fatigue. I just got a call on that yesterday. You know, I read that, and I see all these things all just tied to what they're eating.
Yeah, it's true.
And yet when I tell them, go vegan, there's your answer. I might as well grow a third, you know, two and three heads, because that's as far as that's going to go. But, you know, in between all these horrific diseases, you do have something interesting here. As far as our children, you say vegetarian children have been shown to have significantly higher IQs than average. And it's well known that Thomas Edison, during the years he worked so hard to discover the secrets of electricity, abstained from eating flesh because he found he could think more clearly and make vital connections more easily on a plant-based diet. And other geniuses, including Da Vinci, also did the same. So our kids would not only just be healthier, slimmer, but they'd also be smarter.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I think, you know, eating animal foods is really hard on the, I mean, the brain, the whole, all the functions of the brain, you know, requires clear arteries, but also just the whole idea of not making connections. You know, we don't want to think about where our food comes from. And it just dumbs people down. Really.
Look,
dumb.
Sometimes, you know, you can walk into a public restroom, and when I walk in, I say, whew, I can smell the meat eaters. And you just want to book it for the door. And people don't realize that meat is rotting in your intestines for days before it comes out. And then everybody else has to suffer for it. I don't mean to be gross, but, you know, to me, it's just pretty simple.
Yeah, yeah, we save so much money. You know, I've been, in the last 30 years, I've been a vegetarian, I guess, about 33 years, vegan about 28. Last 30, 33 years, I have never been to a doctor. I have not been to a doctor since my early 20s. I've not gone into a drugstore and bought one pill. One product. I haven't bought anything. I mean, my wife, too. It's like you're free from this whole complex of sickness.
Right, well, it's all, you know, I tell people, they're deliberately trying to kill us all. People say I'm crazy. I said, from the chemtrails, from the filth in our water, pharmaceutical water now. I said, we have pharmaceuticals on tap. People taking pills for this, eating the wrong food. The food's got poisons and toxins in it, which makes you get the medication. Then you got to drink it down with the pharmaceutical water, and you're wondering why you have 100,000 ailments wrong with you.
Yeah, right.
And it really is about taking control over your own life, breaking out of it, you know, snap out of it, like Cher said in that movie, Moonstruck. You know, sometimes you got to slap yourself across the face and say, snap out of it.
Right, right.
Because, you know, we are sucked into this system in ways we don't even think about. And the sad thing is our kids are suffering for it.
Right. Exactly, and there's so much more actually we could talk about with this subject about what the kids are going through. But I guess we'll have to pick it up again.
Yeah, we'll have to save it for next month's Food for Thought, or thoughts to make you not want to eat. But hey, we'll all be thinner, we'll all be healthier, and we'll have better skin, and the earth will be happier. That's for sure.
Oh, the earth and the animals, the wildlife. Wildlife's getting decimated. The whole planet's getting decimated by our food choices.
I know, it's really sad, but I'm glad to know that you're out there with your wife, like, you know, Yukon man out in the open and still communing with all that is.
Right. I wanted to mention, if anyone's interested, on our website, like you mentioned, we just decided to put on a weekend retreat in southeastern Michigan in July, so the details are there, but it'll be a chance to go deeper into the ideas of the World Peace Diet, so anyone who wants to join us for a whole weekend of great vegan organic food and swimming, sunbathing, and discussing these ideas.
Oh, that sounds great. When is it?
It'll be July 18th to 20th.
July 18th to 20th. And you have that on your website, Will Tuttle?
The website. If you go to willtuttle.com or worldpeacediet.org, and they're all connected.
Uh-huh. Yep. Well, aren't we all? I couldn't help it, Will.
Right. Well, thanks.
Well, thanks for co-hosting yet another excellent show, and I'll talk to you next month.
Great. Thank you.
Take care, Will.
Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye. So this Earth Day, instead of, you know, going out and doing some little Earth Day thing or putting a brick in your toilet to save some water, think about really making a difference and change your diet. I tell you all the time, we have two votes. One's our dollar, the other one's our fork. And that second one is what's going to kill us. So thanks for supporting the show. I'll see you guys.
In a world of fear, hatred, and insanity, there is one place to find peace and information without any hidden agenda. The Maria Show. Maria comes from a place of love for all living things, a wry New York wit, and a keen eagle eye on the bad guys, thanks to a great intuition and clarity of mind. Maria does the homework so you don't have to. Maria recognizes the dangers of our times and puts out constant information on how to fight the reptilian agenda of control over the whole planet. From your diet to the government conspiracies, Maria will awaken your mind and free your soul. Subscribe today. If you can afford to subscribe over the requested amount, your soul will be rewarded for helping this brave woman continue on in her fight for real truth, real justice, and the real American way. www.maria.net. That's www.meria.net. We are the ones you've been waiting for, and we didn't come here to lose.